welcome to the 26th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman-Burke. Co-hosting with me is our lich-like troubadour, Lester Crow, and his strolling bones. Also with me tonight is Jordan Bloody Sunboy Steelman and Layla Fridge Gargoyle Mironova. Welcome back to the show.
Howdy.
So how's everybody been? We've had a busy couple weeks. I think we've all gotten a fair amount of gaming in. Also, some exciting news has kind of surfaced. So let's kind of do a little bit of a roundtable and talk about what we've been up to. Jordan, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Yeah. So I had getting back into the campaign that I'm running again. We had our game next session last Saturday, and so that's getting off to a good start. I've been running. Even though we're playing 3rd edition, I've been running 1st edition adventures for my party. So I ran them through the Oldenhaller contract, which is the intro adventure out of the Warhammer core book from 1st edition. And then we moved into Mistaken Identity, which is the lead-in adventure to Shadows Over Bogenhofen, which is the first part of the Enemy Within campaign, the classic campaign that everybody loves.
I'm still embarrassed to say that I've never played any 1st adventure or 1st edition adventures. I kind of started playing mid 2nd edition and have never had an opportunity to go back and play any of the 1st edition ones. I've read several of them, but never played any of them.
Yeah, well, that was actually my start too. I didn't start in the days of 1st edition. I didn't get into Warhammer until, you know, about the mid 2000s, I guess, when 2nd edition was coming in. So, but I've since gone back and tried to collect a lot of the older material that everybody, you know, really loves.
Cool. Lester, well, you started your game, your new session with your new group 2 weeks ago. Have you guys gotten any other gaming in since then?
We played one more session, but not for very long. We're currently trying to get a new player to kind of get into the game, so we don't really want to go much further than we are at this point.
Okay. And you and I talked, you were talking about looking to maybe start recording some of those sessions as well, right?
Yeah, that's the plan. That's kind of why I want to get the fourth member in. It works perfectly that way. That's what I'm used to running. Whenever I ran games of D&D or things like that, I'd play with four players. And so I'm trying to get one more person in to kind of diversify and shore out some of the roles in the company or the group. And then we're going to do some recordings. And I've been mostly doing just homebrew stuff. I'm making the adventures. I'm not playing any of the main adventures yet. They'll probably be worked into the campaign as a whole, but currently It's just stuff that I've been coming up with.
Well, that'd be fun to get another live session series, so we can kind of have three running at a time. That would give a lot of variety to the. To the GMing and playing styles that we've been getting a lot of messages about, that where people really appreciate the live play sessions for inspiration on really just how to play and different things you can do with role playing and the different way people do it.
Yeah, sure.
So Layla, you've been playing too.
I have. I joined up a new campaign, I guess. Is that what you would call it?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I think actually, yeah, Michael Wilson's new game, the Buried But Not Forgotten is what he's called it. Is going to be a campaign or a series of adventures, kind of like a sandbox.
Yeah.
Approach.
Yeah. So I got to do that, a couple of weeks ago? That was pretty fun.
That was the first time you'd played with another GM who was kind of taking it from a very different approach, too, with a whole new group of gamers. And. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, you got everybody talking about their feelings.
I did. My character is a healer, and she's thrown into a group of essentially grumpy men. So, there's a wizard who doesn't reveal anything about himself.
There's a dwarf.
There's a dwarf.
And there's my character who has a little bit of a shady past, and you.
And there's somebody else with father issues, and so I effectively, towards the end, kind of just healed each one of them, and in the process was able to extract some personal information from each of them.
It felt a little bit like a therapy session totally. For everybody. You had all these like stereotypical gamers with bottled up emotions who all have these great backstories that have been written out, but none of them have like this great method to tell everybody what this backstory is. So all of a sudden we have like this healer who's in there just like chatting it up while she's bandaging us, and Everybody's forced to kind of like reveal their histories and their problems. So you guys, I think you guys will get a chance to listen to those sessions. We recorded session 1 and 2 of that over the last 2 weeks. Those will be going up on the web probably later this week. So look forward to those. It's called Buried But Not Forgotten. And speaking of new episodes, once this episode goes live, that'll be Reckless Dice 50th piece of content that we put out there on the web. So
awesome.
I guess the big thing to say is thank you everybody for listening. We greatly appreciate it. We love your guys' comments, and we, do this because we love the hobby, and probably more so because we love the interaction that you guys give us and the guidance you give us on how to make this show fun and exciting for everyone. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And speaking of, interaction with everybody, Facebook has pretty much exploded this week with for the Reckless Dice. We've had loads and loads of excitement going on there over the last couple of days. A lot of people who had maybe been quiet followers have jumped right in with a little hint that we had dropped that we might have a little bit of a surprise for this episode. And indeed, we do have that surprise, which we'll be revealing a little bit later. But rest assured, it's probably everything you guys want and more at this very particular point in time. And I think some people will really like it, and other people are probably really not going to be happy that we have this surprise. But, it is what it is. So, did anybody get a chance to pick up that new Faith of Sigmar, the print-on-demand packet?
No, but sources tell me you did.
I did. I got mine in the mail shortly after we recorded our last session, actually. I like it. It's great. The only part I was concerned about when when I read the press release on the web was that little bit in italics at the bottom where they're saying how they may not feel or look like
the
normal cards. And I don't think that's an issue at all. I think they're fantastic. They feel great. In fact, they maybe even feel a little bit better. So I have no qualms about, with the quality or anything.
Well, that wouldn't even be really an issue for me because I put all the cards into sleeves that the players play with, right, so that they don't get all greasy or destroyed, because we're eating Cheetos and stuff like that, so you don't want to get that.
You guys don't wipe your fingers on your
pants. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm excited to see what more they're going to do with that. I think this one was a pretty good success. Unfortunately, it's not something I'm going to be using, but I'm really glad to have it. I'm looking forward to seeing maybe more applicable ones or maybe more versatile packets that they can release. But it did also give us a little bit of a teaser into what rank 4 and 5 spells would look like for the priests.
Blessings, yeah.
Blessings. Thank you. I was stuck on the word there. With that, do you guys have any other fancy news before we kick it off into our fancy little treat for the listeners?
Nothing that is Warhammer related. No.
Same here.
All right. When we get back, we have a special meetup with Marcus Anderson from Sweden, and he is going to be unboxing the Hero's Call, which he has ready for us to dig through. We're back, and today we have a special opportunity. Marcus Anderson contacted us and said that he had found something special in one of his local stores. Marcus, what was it that you found?
Well, I basically just walked into the store, and Hero's Call was sitting on a shelf.
But Hero's Call doesn't come out for a month.
Yeah. That's right. If I understood it correctly, one of the retailers here in Europe like flew it in from the printers because they didn't want to wait for it shipping to the US and then ship it to Europe. So I don't know.
That's well, I mean, why I can't.
Got it.
So it given the timing. Fantasy Flight is still in the process of going through their marketing cycle for the Heroes Call product. So they still are anticipating in the very near future letting everybody know, for example, what the two new races are, and then probably a couple weeks after that actually releasing the product. So my guess is we're still 3 weeks ahead of schedule at this point.
Yeah, I think so too. I didn't expect to see Heroes Call in Europe until like March or something like that. So
yeah, it's about time that Europe got something before we do over here. Yeah. So.
And I wonder if you're like the only one, because I haven't seen anybody else talk about it yet. Nobody said anything on the boards. Nobody's really had a chance to mention any of the new content yet, which so as far as I know, we might be the first ones to really have a chance to discuss it.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything either, because when I realized it was, I had it much earlier than everyone else, I thought that, well, someone else must have it, but I haven't seen any discussion at all. So, yeah, I don't know.
All right, well, let's hop in and see what we've got in there.
Let's get the discussion going, yeah.
So, Lester and Marcus, I've got some questions here from Facebook and Twitter that'll maybe give us some focus to it, but then let's just kind of keep it flowing with any dig into it any deeper as we as questions come up.
Absolutely.
Jacob McQuaid, friend of the show and also one of the guys who helped me with the big map, he's wondering, am I going to get my halflings or am I going to have to stop buying third edition?
Who will get his halflings?
Cool. And that kind of feeds us straight into the second question then, which is pretty much asked by everybody under the sun, including Brian Skinner, Adam Nash, Stuart Drill. They say, what are the two playable races in Heroes Call?
Yeah, it's the Halflings, as I said, and then it's Ogres.
So yes, I called it.
So it is the Ogres.
Woo! Absolutely.
It's an interesting decision. I
think it's perfect.
I like it. I just don't. How do you feel about it, guys?
Well, it harkens back to the old version of Warhammer. Like, I remember in the Battles game, the Ogres were like mercenary forces, and they were not like a regular sight necessarily around the Empire, but you would see them, and they kind of meld in there with the Empire. So I think it's cool, personally.
Yeah. And they're talking about exactly that Ogres are usually mercenaries or just brutes hanging around the Empire and stuff. So. They kind of go back to that exactly.
So are the two new races introduced? How mechanically are they?
Yeah, that's what I want to
introduced.
Know.
Do we have much background on them, or how do the careers fit into the new races?
Background wise, they get as much text as in the core rulebook.
Okay, races, so several paragraphs.
Yeah. Like a page,
okay,
of text, and then they get this little nice box with their rules and stuff. And
so, are the career abilities for the halfling and the ogre?
The halflings, they can enter any career that a human can enter that possesses the menial or rogue trait. So they will be focused on roguish and menial tasks. And the ogres, they can play any career that both humans and dwarves can enter. So
you can have an ogre ironbreaker? That would be crazy.
I think they must have both human and dwarf. So.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, like coach.
Well, actually, that makes it very narrow.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of.
Mercenary, soldier, things like that.
I was thinking if the Ironbreaker thing was a possibility, it could maybe represent the like the Iron Guts and some of the more like Warhammer Fantasy Battle-esque career choices. But That doesn't quite apply. So the you know how the humans have the favored by fate action, dwarves have night vision
and sturdy, and
grudge.
Right.
Do the halflings and the ogres have anything like that? Kind of their career special.
Yeah, ability? they get race special abilities. The halflings, they get to train like one roguish skill, like ballistic skill or guile or skullduggery and such things, and they get some bonus to sneaky.
They get like fortune dice to stealth.
It sounds like they get to train some of them at character creation. Yeah.
Okay.
So kind of like how the elves.
Yeah, kind of like how the elves get to train education and stuff, and the dwarves get to train resilience or weapon skill.
Yeah.
And then they also have the night vision for the halflings. The ogres, they have pretty much rules, actually, because they get like. They have to eat all the time, so you get the typical ogre who's eating at every turn, and then they have like they can buy strength and toughness cheaper than everyone else, so they will probably be stronger and tougher than the average human. So
I personally would love to play an ogre.
Yeah, I think it would be pretty sweet.
I mean, something I would love you to be a socially...
comedic gold right there. Yeah, totally.
An educated ogre?
No, like a really ambitiously charming ogre. Are there ogre females?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there you go. That's totally my next character.
Having seen the artwork of the male ogres... a female ogre sounds like a horrible sight to behold.
I just imagine like this long Viking cap and like braids underneath a very like awful exterior. Adam Nash would love to know if the new expansion comes with another written adventure.
Yes, it contains an adventure. It does. Maybe I shouldn't say too much because not to spoil it if...
I think that they had disclosed the title of the adventure in one of the first announcement press releases. It had something to do with orcs, if I recall. Or at least it sounded like it did.
Yeah, right. It's the Art of War.
Cool. Then I don't know if you know ahead of time without reading it too far. Is this an adventure that is for rank 4 and 5 characters only? Or is this... kind of where in the spectrum does that adventure fall?
Yeah, I think you should be like rank 4 at least to play
you
the adventure.
Just die.
So it's kind of high level adventure.
Okay.
Which makes sense. I mean, that goes with the theme of the product. So
yeah,
that actually runs nicely into the next question we have from Maya Polo Weja, I think.
Maya Polo Weja.
Weja.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Is this campaign only useful if you have a running campaign with advanced characters, or is there something for a group just starting out as well?
In the expansion in general.
Yeah.
Most of the content is for high-level characters or high-level monsters, but then you have like you could, if you start a campaign, you could be a halfling or you could be an ogre. So then you need it, and then you got all these regional options for humans and dwarves.
Let's not forget to talk about that. I was very curious about those.
Yeah, so it's like, I mean, you could play a character from Stirland or something instead of from Reichland. So then you have to like have this book to begin with.
So what kind of characteristics do you get as you know being from
an Averlander
from Averland or Stirland or you know Kislev or something like that? Because it also included different dwarven settlements.
Yeah,
Favored by Fate was the one that you get as a Reichlander.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming they have something similar like that for the different regions.
Yeah. precisely. I mean, all humans get their 25 creation points, and they have the same wound and corruption threshold. So it's the favored by fate that it's swapped out for different,
kind of regional abilities.
Yeah, precisely. And it can be like the Sturlander characters. They are poor, so they it costs more for them to get to comfortable level when creating mm-hmm. their characters for the wealth. But they get like they're unflinching, so they treat like fear ratings that lower than normal. And they get bonuses right against the undead.
Well, they're right by Sylvania, so that would make sense.
Yeah, precisely. Okay. So mainly it's small bonuses, but it's kind of fun to be able to create characters from different regions.
And so the dwarves got a few as well, is that right?
Yeah, they got three new regions.
Karazakarak, I would imagine, as being one of them.
Yeah, Karazakarak, Barak Var, Zufbar.
Okay, yeah, Zufbar, that's down by the Blackwater or something like that. That's cool. Okay, I happen to know where some of those are from when making the map. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be able to place them. So one of those, the Karazakarak, is the Slayer hold, if I'm not mistaken.
You might be right, actually.
I think that, I wouldn't be surprised if that ability had something specific to do with Slayers then. So one thing we obviously then are not seeing is things like Bretonnia, Tilia, or Astalia.
Or Kislev.
No.
Or Kislev.
Nothing from those regions yet.
So they're all within the Empire.
Okay. Yeah, everything is within the Empire.
So does it do every one of the provinces and then three dwarf races? Is that
it does 9 of the provinces, so it's 10 so with the Reichland.
That would be all of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Moot would get theirs would be within the Halfling thing. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Wilson asks, does Hero's Call leave room for rank 6, or is rank 5 the end?
It does leave room for rank 6, but it haven't got any specific like rules for it or spells at rank 6. So you get like rank 4 actions and rank 5 actions, but they talk about rank 6 for a bit, at least, somewhere in the book. But
so maybe you keep gaining experience, but there's no action cards
yeah.
to kind of go along with that new rank.
Yeah, it's kind of like what we've had with our rank 4 and rank 5 up till now. So, so not very much about rank 6 and above.
Is there much of a gap between rank 3 and rank 4?
Not really. You get a little better. The rank 4 careers are, they have like more talent slots, and in some cases they have more career skills than the lower ranks. But there wouldn't be a problem having like some rank 3 characters and some rank 4 characters in the same group. So I think it's...
You mentioned some of the new careers. If I'm not mistaken, there's 12 new careers in the Hero's Call box. Can you go over what those careers are?
Yes. You're right. There is 12 of them. And you get 3 for the priests. It's like the lector, the warrior priest, and the arc lector.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the lector and warrior priest, they are rank 4 careers, and then you go to the Arc Lector, which is the rank 5 career.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've done similarly for the wizards. You could go into Battle Wizard or Master Wizard at rank 4, and then you go into Wizard Lord at rank 5. Then the Ogres and Halflings each get a starting race, or a basic race. So the Ogres, they get the Ogre Man-Eater race.
Okay.
and the halflings get halfling chef.
Chef, is that kind of like a thief?
Oh, chef. Like a
chef. Oh, chef. Oh, okay. Oh, great. Excellent. Halfling pies are on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you get like a champion, which is basically a fighting career at rank 4. And you get a crime lord, which might be good if you're like a thief or assassin or something to move into at rank 4. And we've got a vampire hunter, which is probably natural if you've gone through the witch hunter steps. Yeah. And then there is magistrate, which is the social rank 4 career.
So that's kind of a high-level noble.
Yeah.
Okay.
Precisely.
Are we getting any kind of epic bad guys or good guys?
Yeah. There are many epic bad guys introduced. So seems like they're setting up for some really epic battles. We have like Archeon, and we have Grimgor Ironhide, and Manfred von Karsten.
Sure, definitely recognize powerful, those ones.
Such powerful characters.
So how do they make these really powerful characters powerful? I mean, what is it similar just to how they've handled like a Bloodthirster or something like that in the other books, or is there really something unique about these epic bad guys?
Yeah, they've done creature cards for them, obviously, and they get really good statistics on those. Mm-hmm. And then they get special rules, which are kind of making them even more special. They've got like like Archeon, he has knows like all chaos spells, and he has all the marks of the different Sweet. Chaos gods.
Oh,
so
wow.
You have to like add them to your to him, so he becomes really, really powerful. And he's also got like in previous content, monsters generally only had a few expertise dice to play with, but here they get actual training in skills. So many of them have like a couple of ranks at least in weapon skill. So that will make them a lot more powerful to handle for the player characters, I'd say.
Getting lots of righteous successes and like critical hits and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What are the how many named epic bad guys are included? Is it just those three, or is there a few more?
I think there are about 8 named bad guys. So it's from different races and different.
Because if I recall, I think you even get like Grimgor's wyvern mount.
Yeah.
I bet maybe Archeon. He had a special named horse that he rode on.
Yeah, he was one of the like artifacts that he had to collect in order to gain power.
And then I think Galrok, that Tzeentch chaos dragon. I think I seem to recall that being mentioned at some point.
Yeah,
is there a Skaven character?
Absolutely. There are
There is a Skaven character. Oh, yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to hear some of the more like kind of wonky stuff, and you know, and then I had one other follow-up question to that, but I want to hear what we've got in here first.
Yeah, it's a Greyseer, Thankwheel.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He's, for those of you who don't know, he's kind of the most well-known Skaven Greyseer. I think he's unofficially kind of in charge of things in the Skaven world. I'm not sure he's actually like, I can't recall if he's actually on the Council of 13 or if he's just kind of a really heavy hitter in that society.
I think he does. I think he represents the like Greyseers on the Council of 13.
Okay. Nice. But, that's a good one.
Then we have Lokir Fellheart, the Dark Elf.
Okay.
He's the guy who wears that cool squid mask.
Yeah, precisely.
Oh, I've seen the picture. I didn't recognize the name.
Kasak One Eye. That's a beastman.
Okay.
And then we had, like I said, Manfred von Karsten, Grimgor Ironhide. Archeon. Let's see if there are any more of the named ones.
Are the other ones generic?
Or? How do they do that socketing thing? Because they alluded to having like a card or an ability to make just your other regular guys stronger.
Yeah, precisely. It's a card in the size of a career card in which you put one of your monster cards. And then you get bonuses to like wounds and their strength, their ability scores, and their they get extra action cards, and they get like extra aggression and cunning and expertise dice. So you actually slot the whole card onto a card the size of career card, and it just adds bonuses.
It sounds like that's a good way to make a nemesis NPC, or like, you know, a villain, because it almost puts them on the same level, it sounds like, as a player character.
Yeah.
Where you have, you know, even in size and shape and look and feel, they almost act like a real player.
Yeah, precisely. There are several different like levels of how powerful you want to make your enemies. So there is like a hero level, which could be just a bit better fighter for a combat, but then you have like you could have like a mastermind and make him the focus of a whole campaign, I think, because they get pretty powerful with these cards, which is fun.
So we have these epic bad guys. Are there epic good guys?
That would be the player characters.
Okay, well, I was thinking, like, you know, we have, like, Grimgor, Ironhide, we have Archeon. Do we get Carl Franz? Do we get, you know, some of the other named good guys that you might be able to encounter? Or is it...
No, nothing like that. Okay. It's just the bad guys.
Oh, okay. Well, because it seems to me like they are gearing up and providing the foundation for the Storm of Chaos. And in the Storm of Chaos, there's a series of special or named characters that appear. And some of those are good guys and some of those are bad guys.
Huss and all those
guys. Right. Exactly. And I'm wondering at what point are we going to start seeing those?
Probably in the campaign that you've
probably
guessed. I think you're right. Yeah. I think that's what they're going to do, is release a series of campaign products, or just one product that is a long campaign, and it will introduce those guys.
Absolutely. That's what I think too, that when they release the campaigns, they will start releasing the powerful good guys as well, or at least some information about them.
I think that's the path, like the arc they'll follow on the campaign, is it'll probably get the player characters may or may not be involved directly in the storyline. Like they might meet up with Luthor, Huss, or, you know, whatever.
I'm trying to remember what some of the other bad guy heroes were.
There
was a couple lesser heroes that appeared in that. I remember there's one particular Chaos Warrior or General.
There's Sirtha Link, who's the Chaos General.
I'll have to dig back into my books and see if I can figure out what they are.
Yeah, Sirtha Link was the guy who sent the original attack into the Empire before they... And they actually talk about him in the core rulebook at the beginning, when it's kind of setting up the state of the world. It talks about Sirtha Link.
Are there any item or location cards included?
Yeah, a couple. There are a couple of items, mainly the gut plate for the ogres, which they get.
Excellent.
And then there are some adventure-specific items, so I won't be mentioning more about those.
Oh, okay.
And then you get some, like epic locations. You get like a Warpstone crater, which would be a
cool
place to have a fight.
Cool.
And then we have like a lava flow, so a burning river of molten stone runs through the area. So it would be a great place to have a fight.
We don't have any location cards for like a Chaos Waste or anything yet, do we?
Mm-mm.
That'd be a neat one to see at some point.
Yeah, that would be great. So that's where the location cards, only two of them.
Cool. Well, Daniel Weiss was a little disappointed with the Demonette artwork, and he wonders what the artwork in Heroes Call is like.
In general, I like it, but I'm not an art critic, so...
I think what his main criticism, I think, Lester, do you recall the artist who did the Demonette and the... and I think it was the Keeper of Secrets. I want to say Adrian Smith. I'm not sure that's right.
That's one of the really good ones. But
he has a very stylized sketchbook kind of approach to his art, and it seemed that the his artwork, particularly in, he's a great artist, but the use of his art in the tokens was, I think, rather questionable. I don't think I'm the only one in that boat. But are all of the tokens and artwork in this series kind of the similar style? And yeah, is it?
I'd say they are. Cool. So it's good.
So what kind of tokens and creatures do you are we going to see in this?
Aside from all the named monsters, we get some. We get the Black Orcs once again, but we also get like the Sword of Chaos, which is like Archeon's bodyguard or cool. Something like that. And then we get some monsters like War Hydras and let's see.
I imagine we get some ogres and some halflings.
Yeah.
Do we get a couple of them, or is it just one or two?
For the stand-ups, we get like a couple of ogres, but only one for the like player characters, and then one for the halfling. So
still pretty slim pickings for stand-up options.
Yeah, you're kind of stuck with a halfling chef if you're playing a halfling.
Because there's the Halfling Chef, and then there was one other Halfling token that came in the Gathering Storm campaign. So if you have many supplements, you'll have two character stand-up options as a Halfling.
Yeah, precisely. And here you get like the Ogre Man-Eater artwork for a stand-up, or just a generic Ogre, because they also show up as a monster on a monster card, a creature card.
Well, all of a sudden, our bestiaries that we all own are no longer complete. We're going to have the Heroes Call book and the bestiary.
Yeah. Exactly, because the Heroes Call contains all of the epic monsters and antagonists, and it's laid out kind of like the creature guide.
Okay.
But, now we need to have two books if we're going to use monsters from both the Creature Guide and from the Heroes Call.
So, Lester, is there anything else that you think that, or Marcus for that matter, anything else that you guys think that we should know or that we haven't kind of talked about that comes in the box set?
I can't think of anything necessarily. I mean, Marcus would be the better one to ask, because
the talents, there are some new talents, and they've
been
quite a smart thing with the talents, because many of the new talents replace previous talents.
So, like upgrade versions?
Yeah, precisely. Kind of like the improved block and similar. So you can buy talents, but you don't get more talent cards, because that has been kind of a problem for my group, that from the beginning everyone bought maximum amount of talents, and then you have to buy one each time you go through a career. They're starting to accumulate quite a lot of talents, but now you can buy some talents and replace your old talents when you get to rank 4. Kind of preventing the PCs from having too many talents. thing around.
Is there anything really worth specifically mentioning regarding the new action cards? From what I understand, there's certainly going to be spells and priestly spells. And I assume there are also rank 4 and 5 social and martial actions as well. Can you elaborate a little bit on what's included?
The main part is the spells and the blessings. It's mm-hmm. It's probably more than half of the pile is for those. But you get some epic actions for fighting careers and for social actions as well. But they're kind of few. I was hoping for more. Because I think you get like maybe 12 or 15 action cards that aren't spells or blessings. Mm-hmm. And then the spells, you get like 2 rank 4 spells and 1 spell at rank 5 for each and every of the orders or faiths. But for the other characters, it's kind of thin, I think. We could have elaborated more on fighting and social actions for high-ranking characters.
I kind of wonder what you would even... What could you conceive as a rank 5 social action? I'm struggling to come up with an idea.
That's probably
applicable.
Yeah, maybe that's why they haven't done so many. They've done at least an enhancement card for social actions, so you can sacrifice dice to get bonuses for your social actions, and that's on rank 4. You could get that, so that's kind of a fun way to do it. But other than that, they haven't included very much in the social area.
I think that'll come with their print on demand. I mean, assuming that they keep that up and like support it, and I'm assuming they'll boost the cards through that.
Yeah, probably. And maybe throughout the sprinkled throughout the other expansions as well, that they put in some rank 4 or 5 actions every now and then.
Cool.
But now it's a lot for the priests and wizards and a few cards for the fighting careers, and like 1 or 2 for the social.
Cool. Fantastic. Well, I think unless you can think of anything else that's absolutely groundbreaking that we've forgotten from Heroes Call, I think that's a fantastic summary of what we can all look forward to.
Yeah. No, I don't think there's anything else to really say. They have a new format on the map. They included a map for the adventure.
There's a map?
Yeah.
Oh.
And they have changed, like, it's not on a career-sized card. It's, like, twice as big. And in a different material. So it's... I like it, actually. It's not fitting in with the other maps, but... It's definitely more map-like.
Oh, neat.
It's a better handout, I think, because it feels more like a map and looks more like a map.
That's sweet.
Excellent.
So that's kind of fun.
Oh, well, that's my favorite part already.
Yeah, I like maps a lot myself.
Well, Marcus, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to talk with you and go through the contents of the Heroes Call.
Yeah, this show's so much better when the community participates, eh?
Yeah, thanks for letting me participate.
Facebook was absolutely on fire this afternoon and yesterday trying to anticipate what this interview might entail. So I don't think we've disappointed. I think I got about every question I could have wanted, and I think we've answered every question the community had for you.
Yeah.
So
except for the one about boobs.
You're right. Yeah. Boobs did come up in Facebook a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's we don't have anything to address that issue.
No, there's very few boobs. even in Dark Souls.
There was a specific request to not have man boobs. So,
well, but there's ogres, though, so there's probably lots of man boobs.
I mean, the female ogres.
Well, I guess ogre boobs. Yeah, yeah, it's true. But I don't know, is there a picture of a female ogre in the book?
No, I haven't seen one. I haven't seen any picture of a female ogre, actually.
I mean, I can picture what the men ogre look, the male ogres look like, and
yeah.
A female ogre, even if it was more attractive, sounds like a horrible experience.
Yeah.
No offense to any ogres out there.
That's right.
I mean, boobs are boobs, right?
All right, and with that, we will kick it off for a short break, and we'll come back with some questions and answers. So, as always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com. Like Ben Fistner, who actually he tweeted to us, where you can access us at Reckless Dice. And it's a question from episode 23. What is some good inspiration for a campaign that doesn't default to some of the Warhammer Fantasy roleplay cliche? What do you guys think he's referring to there?
Chaos, I think the cliche would be chaos. Yeah, exactly. The enemy within. That would be the cliche, I would assume. Maybe orcs kicking the door in. That would also be kind of a cliche.
Yeah.
And you know, as much as we've joked about that, I've never used it.
Mm-hmm. What, the orcs kicking the door in?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cliches all relative, right? I mean, like my players are in this instance, they're totally new to Warhammer, so I'm throwing the enemy within, which I guess, you know, long timers might consider fairly cliche because it's, you know, all about chaos and cults and all that stuff, but they've never seen it before. So it's totally new to them.
Mm. But I mean, I would still say that's the cliche for Warhammer though. I mean, most of the adventures are centered around chaos.
To me, the cliche and what I think he's referring to is adventuring party arrives at location. Location seems okay on the surface, but ultimately something funny is going on. They find out what something funny is. Turns out it's a chaos cult. They end up fighting the chaos cult, and everything goes back to normal.
Yeah.
That's kind of the cliche that I'm assuming he means.
He should just listen to all the episodes with Helga, because I'm pretty sure those stray far from cliche.
Well, you could always just have it where they show up at a place, it seems peachy on the surface, and it turns out to be peachy on the surface, and nothing bad happens, and they just have a good time, and you know.
Everyone goes home drunk.
Yeah, sip on some wine and dance a little bit, and roll the dice to see how well they dance, and then go home.
So from a perspective of all the published adventures so far seem to kind of have, for the most part, that cliche style to it. What do you guys think are some good alternatives to those?
There's a lot of untapped kind of factions in the old world that don't get used a lot, I think, or at least they kind of get used more as a way to nudge the plot along, but they're not used as kind of plots in and of themselves. I think the Greenskins is a good example.
Yeah.
Usually they're just kind of set up to be, you know, some like an instigator, like, oh no, there's a group of goblins and they're attacking a coach, you know, but actually trying to dive into, you know, some kind of goblin or orc plot or the rise of an orc war boss or something like that could be something different.
I was going to follow something very similar to what you just said, which was maybe on a more basic level, try approaching an adventure that's a little more just in your face and basic with some bad guys.
Yeah.
The whole multi-tiered unveiling of the enemy can get a little dull if that's what you're doing every time. Is sometimes have the bad guy be the bad guy and have it be a blunt force bad guy.
Or you could put it in where the other like good guys, quote unquote good guys, I guess, would be your antagonists, where you're working against other factions of good, I guess. Like you could have a plot involving the Church of Renald or something like that, where some thieves are trying to steal something, but your party has been hired by this other force to stop that from happening or something like that.
Or maybe beating other good guys to the punch, maybe where multiple good factions are competing to do something and they're all good guys and it's just a matter of winning.
Yeah, that's kind of plays into, I think, an element that is ideally central in Warhammer, but that maybe gets glossed over by a lot of folks, is that Warhammer is all about, there's not really a whole lot of black and white in Warhammer. It's just all shades of gray. Yeah. So it's not, with a few exceptions, you know, obviously.
Well, some red and green too, though.
Yeah, but there's a lot of, these guys, you know, maybe they're, apologies if you can cut that out. My dog is being a pain.
No, we're leaving it. Anyway. Everybody's going to know your dog is now an international superstar.
You have got a dog. Yes,
and she will love that, I can tell you.
What's her name?
Anyway, but yeah, shades of gray, like not using just outright, you know, these people are evil and these people are good, but these people, well, you know, there's merit to what they're doing, but these people have some merit to what they're doing, which, how do we, you know, what do we do? What side do we choose? You know,
how do you guys feel about doing adventures that are, if you get tired of the cliche inside the Empire doing something, what if you take similar story concepts but take them outside of the Empire in places that are much more, you know, very foreign, you know, like, you know, maybe down to the Badlands or Araby or Lustria or the Badlands or Norska?
Well, I have a whole idea right now. I've been working on a mind map to kind of give a sandbox environment, and I have an underlying plot that I'm kind of working on right now that involves Lustria in a large way, because do you guys know about like ancient alien theory and like Eric von Daniket, Chariots of the Gods and stuff like that?
No, I knew. I'm familiar with most of what you said until you got near the end there.
You don't know
odd people?
Well, kind of. It's just basically the whole idea of Warhammer, like its background history or whatever about the aliens coming and creating life on the world or on the planet itself, kind of plays into the whole Chariots of the Gods thing, which is a fantastic book about ancient alien theory. And I kind of, I'm trying to work that into a Warhammer-y kind of campaign.
Can we all like maybe do an adventure where the twin-tailed comet was actually a spacecraft and the twin tails were the engines and then Sigmar was actually a space marine? And he was superhuman, and then and I think that all fits perfectly.
Yeah, he was Superman. Totally,
he was one of the lost Primarchs. Are you familiar with 40K?
A little bit, not overly.
I'd love to do an adventure in Lustria. And the Tomb Kings. Those two are kind of my go-to locations when I want to mix it up a bit and do something crazy. So, my one of my favorite adventures is still the Lure of the Lich Lord from second edition. At some point in probably the very near future, I'm going to try and run that adventure for our crew. And we'll have some fun with that, I hope.
I've always wanted to explore the Border Princes more. Yeah. I think that's good. Fertile ground is close enough to the Empire and to, you know.
And you can create it however you really want. There's a loose idea of what it's like, but it's constantly shifting and changing. So
yeah, well, and everybody who lives in the Border Princes are the people that were kicked out because, you know, for one reason or another, they weren't wanted. So they're not going to be nice people.
Yeah, totally.
That's where Helga's new character is from. Or Helga, Layla's new character.
Yeah, Ella.
Ella.
Yeah.
Ella Fitzgerald?
No.
No. So David Cole emails us, I have my own party concept and would like to create a party card for my players. Do you know if there's a place where I can get my hands on a nifty-looking template for this, or will I need to build the whole thing from scratch?
I don't know if they have that on the Strange Eons. I don't know if they have the party sheet-sized.
So for those unfamiliar with Strange Eons, give us a little idea of what that is.
As far as I know, it was a program, a downloadable program that was built to make custom homemade cards for one of the Call of Cthulhu games that Fantasy Flight Games produced. And people have put a bunch of different modules into it, one of which is the Warhammer Fantasy. And you can build like item cards, and there's like location cards and action cards with templates. But I don't know if there are.
And it kind of like pre-produces some of the graphics and stuff for you, right?
Yeah, like exactly. There's templates that are laid out that have like conservative and reckless side. And then all you do is you go in and you enter the text into like predefined areas, and you know, it even has the symbols built in and everything. So but I'm not sure. I don't think they have the party sheet sized template. So
I'm going to go on a limb and probably say they don't. But on the other hand, you know, you can always kind of wing it or just write up the rules for yourself. And I mean, you can always try scanning it and Photoshopping out some of the text, but that if you're not really too fancy with Photoshop, that might get a little difficult quickly. I think you're kind of out of luck at the moment, unless Strange Eons has a module for that. But I sort of feel that's unlikely.
And with Strange Eons, I mean, if you even have a tiny bit of knowledge about programming, which I don't, but you can go in and it has all the tools built in there where you could create your own template within the program itself. So
I've yet to really explore Strange Eons. It intrigued me early on, and then it kind of just got set aside and never really happened. But
I played around with it quite a bit. It's pretty sweet.
Is it easier to use than it looks? Because I looked through some of the programming language, and I got intimidated.
Well, for creating your own cards with the pre-made templates, it's easy. But for making your own templates, you have to have like coding knowledge, which I don't have.
Okay. So if you're willing to work with the templates that already exist,
if you want to make action cards or item cards, it's amazing.
Oh, okay. Well, I should check that out. Well, friend of the show, Aaron Mokhtar, the Klingon from New Zealand.
Yes.
He asks us via Facebook, is anyone out there familiar using the D&D Dungeon Tile Masters set? And is it a good buy?
I'm not familiar with using it, but I would assume that it would be great. I mean,
does anybody here own it?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, though, I do believe there's a guy on YouTube in the YouTube RPG community whose handle is Your Dungeon Master. Yeah. And if I recall, he does reviews of a whole lot of the different D&D tile sets. And I think the dungeon tiles was one of them. He actually kind of unboxes it, so he shows you, you know, every tile and every, you know, bit that's included in it. So I would definitely check that out. I seem to recall him doing it, but I don't remember
Well, there's a couple different ones from a bunch of the different tile sets.
Right, that's what I was about to say, because I own two of the sets. And
do you own the one with the box, where you can use the
yes,
box as like an
upgrade? Yeah, so there's the one that Aaron's referring to here is one of the ones in the box. It's the gray one, and it comes with a series of double-sided hardboard, nicely printed tiles with a variety of sizes that you can kind of generate a dungeon on the fly with. Mm-hmm. And the quality of it's amazing. It's beautifully printed. It actually, from a scale perspective, works very well with the punch outs for Warhammer. And my favorite part is the organizer in me. The box that it comes in is very similar in quality to the other boxes that we all love from the Warhammer supplement. So it makes another great transporting box or storage box for your stuff. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, it looks really cool. The one I think is a better buy than the dungeon tile set is the starter set or the wilderness set. And it's one that allows you to build forests and lakes and roads. And I really think that one you'd get a lot more use out of. Comes in the exact same style box with a little bit different graphics. And they're very cheap. I think each box was like $20. And it comes with a lot of content for $20.
That's interesting. I was kind of wondering about that wilderness set. I almost went and picked it up at one point just because I thought I might be able to use it in my games.
Really, I mean, I think the $20 is worth the box, but I'm kind of I'm not sure I can fully justify that. But I love the boxes. I use the boxes more than I do the content that was in them. But the wilderness one's really cool. It's got like the overturned coach. It's got the roads, the rocks, the trees. Very, very versatile. The dungeon one, not as much, particularly when you're talking Warhammer, where there's a lot less dungeon crawls.
Yeah, it's not about going into the building, killing the monster, taking his loot, going into the next room, yada, yada, yada.
Now, we actually used the Wilderness one in our epilogue game for the Witch's Song, where we did the big combat with the Dark Elves out in the swamp. Did you feel that added to the game, or kind of the spatial awareness of kind of having a little bit of a map?
Yeah, definitely. I actually personally love anything that gives me more spatial awareness, like on a visual level. So I thought it was good.
Okay. Well, it kind of does, in a sense, detract from the way that the game is designed, where you have that abstract movement concept, an abstract location concept, but I personally like maps and visuals, so yeah. I think it's fun. Well, and given the price, it's a deal.
Well, most players I know, they appreciate that. It works better that way for them, especially new players.
Cool. Well, also, speaking of maps, I'm doing another update to the super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. I'm adding the content for the Ogre Kingdoms into the Mountains of Morn area off to the far right. That's to update it with the content from the Warhammer Fantasy Battles Ogres book, and I'll also be updating the new content from the Vampire Counts book. So very timely with the release of Heroes Call and the two new races.
Yeah.
So Neil Foster writes in, great show, guys. Still waiting on the Lure of Power to arrive in the UK. This one might be a little bit...
I think it's dated.
Might be a little dated. I hope he's not still waiting. So I have a question about retainers. Are they extensions of the existing rules for pets and horses, i.e. simplified to a single characteristic like obedience, or are they more closer to a full-fledged NPC that the character controls?
The latter.
Yeah.
And definitely.
What? The character kind of controls them in the sense that the character can order them about. But I mean, the game master in the long run would control them. Like if they're like getting picked on or whatever, they're going to, you know, run away or whatever. I mean, because I don't like, do you buy them as, I don't think you purchase them with advances. I think you just have to be able to pay for them to be able to have the retainer.
So a retainer is effectively like a NPC who, follows your character around, or like a hireling.
Yeah.
You know, so you could be like, you know, a chef or a bodyguard or...
He's retained.
Retained, yeah. So you've got him on retainer, like a lawyer. And you get it now?
I do.
And they have NPC stats very similar to what you'd see in a specialist NPC from the character cards. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a little monster card with some statistics on the requirements to maintain them and the benefits that they give you. So they are, in a sense, a simplified NPC character that you control.
Yeah, except there's no picture on them.
No, there's not. There's like a whole bunch of text data on that one. All right, we're getting into some of the current ones. We're digging through our Q&A this time because over the last several episodes, we've had little time to go through it, but we still had a lot of questions rolling in. So we should have some very interesting ones coming up here. So Josh Portheus Cordero, he sends us an email entitled "A New GM and Lover of Warhammer Roleplay." He has three questions. He is he's very interested in writing his own adventures, or at least branching off from some of the published stuff. Is there any resources that we would recommend?
I would say Sigmar's Heirs from Second Edition would be really, really good.
I hear people reference that one a lot, and I don't get it. Why? Well, what's so great about that particular book?
Well, because it gives you all sorts of information about the different provinces of the Old World in general, which helps you, or of the Empire especially. It gives you all sorts of basic knowledge, so you can play you could play people from different places more accurately. That's got tons of built-in plot hooks. It really details quite effectively all the separate provinces, the law of the Empire, and all sorts of different tasty bits.
Yeah, it's really a nitty-gritty kind of encyclopedia of the Empire. So getting you familiar with the different provinces and the different people that live there, and then
like their sayings and the way they perceive the rest of the Empire, and the way the rest of the Empire perceives mm-hmm. them, and stuff.
And
like
it even it comes with some useful inspiration in terms of like lists of towns, villages, and cities within the different provinces, and it gives you an idea for, you know, population size, which you can take that, and then you can, or you know, imports and exports,
like that, yeah.
And yeah, you can derive inspiration. You know, you pick a city off of this list, and you're like, oh, I see that this is a town that's barely self sufficient with only 78 people. Wouldn't that be interesting if we did, you know, went off on an adventure there?
Yeah, and it's ruled by Baron, you know, such and such German name. Right. Insert German name here, you know.
It also gives information about the moot and the halflings.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll be seeing some of that in the Heroes Call, too,
yep.
Given that halflings are a confirmed race now.
Yeah.
He also has run into another problem, at least in his head, with his PCs. Even after letting them choose who and what they want to be halfway into the adventure, specifically the Edge of Night, they want to change their characters because they don't like their character. He wants his PCs to have fun and enjoy the game as much as he does, but the idea of switching careers in the middle of an adventure is driving him nuts. How would we as seasoned GMs handle this?
Well, if they want to change it costs.
Say no.
Well, yeah. That's totally an option, and probably if you're trying to, you know, have continuity be an if that's really important to you, then that's probably the best way you can go about doing it. I mean, do it obviously in like a not a heavy-handed way, but try to compromise a little bit. But if they really want to change it, it costs them a lot of advances, like at least 2 advances just to change their career. It doesn't not to give them any benefits or bonuses. It just changes their career. So,
but I mean, would you? Just to play devil's advocate, would you do that at the cost of making your player unhappy?
Yeah, Steve, I wouldn't say no to my player. If they really wanted to change their career midway through the adventure, I'd be like, okay, because there is a price to pay for that. They have to waste their advances that could go towards things that would probably be more useful in the end, like through the rest of the adventure, than it would be, you know, to change their career. Because what does that really do for them?
I mean, Helga kind of had this problem too, right?
Did I change careers?
No, but you were kind of like struggling with, well, what am I going to do with my character? I don't know what to do. And you were kind of stuck in the position of maybe not as adamantly as his players, but where you were kind of floundering mid-adventure of like, getting pulled, like, I want to be a witch, I want to be a mage, I want to, not sure what I want to do here.
I guess that's true, but I mean, you can't always get what you want, so.
Yeah.
Just tell them to deal with it for like another 2 sessions.
Yeah. But yeah, I think maybe that it hints at maybe a greater issue that's going on with the players, in that maybe they don't feel motivated about, you know, what kinds of, the kinds of characters that they're playing. Maybe they,
should listen to episode 25.
Well, I think that's what, I think he made a really good point when he talked about, how it's just better to have people randomly generate what they are and then just get used to it. You know, it's something to work towards to like change your career, in my opinion.
I kind of, I'm not against players changing it up midway, especially if they can come up with a way that logically would make sense from a storytelling perspective. If someone wants to abandon a career midway, but there's a great reason for their character to do that, and it's not like, oh, I'm a knight and I want to start casting spells, I'm going to become a wizard. No, but if it's like, I'm a knight and things are going badly and I'm not able to handle myself and I'm resulting in petty thievery and all of a sudden I'm going to transition to a burglar, well, that makes sense to me, and maybe that would, you could maybe forgive some of the necessary advances to abandon a career if you can kind of come up with a reason that's strong enough.
Yeah. But the same quandary can come up with just them picking up a new skill or a fortune dice to an ability midway through an adventure. So is that the same problem? Does he have a problem handing out advancements during the adventure so they can mark off this? Because all of a sudden now they're better at, you know, say lock picking or whatever, skullduggery, even though they haven't really been practicing that, but that's something that the player wants to do. I mean, that comes down to a metagame issue, I guess. So.
Well, there's also the element that Warhammer, is it a matter of what the characters are playing from a role-playing perspective, or are they upset with the actual mechanical career that they've chosen? Because that there's been some discussion on the boards, but where people are finding that they're tying their character too specifically to the career and having that dictate their character, where it should kind of be the other way around, where any character can be in a career. If they're not happy with the character and backstory they've developed, it's going to, you know, the career they're in really doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's not like a class in D&D at all.
Yeah, I was going to speak to that too, because I just recently was reading through that thread where they were talking, you know, I think it started off by somebody asking, you know, what's the point of careers, because careers are so generic, and, you know, but I think that thread ended up hitting a really important topic that maybe is the center of the issue that's going on here, is that characters, especially in third edition, because third edition's career system is so unspecified, it's so open and flexible, that the career means very little in and of itself. It's really more about, you know, the role play and the skills and the path that the player chooses to take the character. And the career itself, in a mechanical sense, is such a minor part of the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's also just the Warhammer experience, that, you know, you just, you take what you're given and you make the best of it. You know, make lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Or limeade out of lime juice.
Just deal with it.
Yeah.
So his last question is on dealing with what he has dubbed as cockroaching. And he says his PCs, especially in story mode, love to give me mini heart attacks by splitting up in a million directions. How do you deal with that? Do you have any tips on how to keep them together or at least close to each other?
I like Lila's idea. No. You can't. You know.
Well, I mean, we all get it. We're like, you know, we experienced it in our last game where everybody's in the tavern and two players are like, okay, I'm going to go to bed. Mm-hmm. And the other's like, well, I'm going to go gamble. And then the other one's like, well, I'm going to go to the bar. And all of a sudden the GM's like, okay, well, now I have, you know, three things to deal with independently. That's a simple example as opposed to other scenarios. I think we had people going to different areas of town.
Well, when we did Michael Wilson's campaign, we all started in separate places, in fact, and he kind of manipulated it so that we wound up together. So that was him doing a lot of the writing and the work. I suppose you, as the GM, you could just manipulate it that way.
Yeah. And if you have player characters that are split up amongst different activities and everything, I think the key is just to kind of keep it, keep what you're doing with them, you know, fast paced, kind of just keep the energy flowing, and then just go around the table, hitting up each player and making sure, you know, don't spend more than 5 minutes with one player, and then you know, make sure you're moving on to the next guy.
I'd bust up the little tracking things and just do it just like an initiative order where these guys get to make an action in their situation or resolve a simple situation, and then I move on and move on and move on and move on.
Well, as a player, I hate or cringe when everybody splits up. I think that
we pulled it off pretty good in that, with a little help from my friends, though.
We did, but he handled it beautifully. Where he bounced back and forth almost like it was a TV show.
Exactly.
Where, you know, it's like, meanwhile, but I feel
back at the bat, kid.
Yeah, but it's like whenever I'm a player and I see the group split, I know immediately that I'm going to be sitting twiddling my thumbs for 5 or 10 minutes at a time while we're playing. And I do my best as a player not to split up the group. And as a GM, I really, if I can help it, try not to allow the players to split. If they want to visit two different locations, great. Let's take the group to each location, as opposed to letting two people go off one direction, two people go in another. If the players are really have their heart set on it, we can make it work. But
you can always fall back on the fridge gargoyle method. No.
Just say no.
No.
you're like the drug dog with the French coat.
Just say no.
Yeah. And then as a GM, if you're feeling particularly devilish, you could just always pull the ninja trick. My players have learned that splitting up usually means that one or more of them gets attacked. So the dwarf now has sworn that he'll never leave the party again because they always get attacked whenever he's gone.
Well, alternatively, there's also the option of just telling your players, hey, I know this sounds like it's a good idea, but from a mechanical and fun perspective, it's kind of a crappy thing.
Especially when it happens all the time, right? Like,
if your players aren't aware that it's happening and they just are playing their character, not realizing they're causing a road bump for everybody in the group, just maybe let them know. And they may have not considered the impact of it.
Yeah. And when the PCs are split up too, that means that they're not getting the opportunity to interact with one another. So they're not building the you know, inter-party role play.
Good call.
Which is the best. That's always the best when that happens.
Yeah, it shouldn't be about one person's, one player's role playing. It should be about everybody role playing off of each other. That's where the fun happens.
I totally agree.
Lester, do you want to read off our next question?
Richard emails, enjoying your podcast immensely.
Is that his last name, Emails?
I don't know. Richard Emails, that's a sweet last name. I mean, he's got good grammar if he was born.
Do you think he invented email?
Maybe. Okay, so trying to get back to his question, after being so rudely interrupted, he says, enjoying your podcast immensely, very useful for us newcomers to WH. I'm assuming that means Warhammer. To hear the
literal.
even though Warhammer is one word. Yeah.
To hear the history of the world from the old guard. I really feel flattered being considered the old guard. I mean, I've been around Warhammer a long time, but I wouldn't even come close to considering myself the old guard.
But you have a beard though.
I mean, not currently actually.
You are halfway to being a beardy old gamer.
It's true, and I do I get kinda like crotchety when it comes to older varieties of games. I mean, I prefer board games to video games. But anyway, I really want to not screw this guy's question up. So he says, I'm also enjoying your APs. I'm assuming that means actual plays.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Again, your literalness is astounding.
Listening to others play through the published adventures and seeing how wildly they differ from other adventures or other adventurers' attempts to complete the same adventure is great. Show of varied types of people who enjoy playing RPGs. Anyway, on to the question. Whew. Thanks, man. I agree. The rule of burning iron spell says, effect, all metallic items on a target's person glow with burning heat. Each time you remove a charge token from this card, the target suffers damage equal to your intelligence plus armor's soak value. His armor soak value is useless against this damage. So he wonders, he says, I can see why heated armor should not contribute to soaking the damage the armor itself inflicts, but I can't see the reason why holding a shield would make the heat more bearable. This leads me to the conclusion that I don't understand the difference between soak and armor soak. And although I thought armor soak was soak, that specifically comes from armor, not spells, blessings, talents, or shields. So I think, what I think is that the shield does count towards it. Because this is the ultimate Ironbreaker Destroyer spell. They have so much soak with their Gromril armor, and if they're holding a shield too, the shield has soak, right? Or does it have defense?
Well, I know the dwarf in my game is using a tower shield, and I know for a fact that one adds both defense and soak. So
the soak value of that would be added into it. It's not just the body armor. I'm almost positive the shield counts towards that because it's all metal items on their person.
Right. Yeah, effectively, the idea of the spell is that the armor you're wearing becomes the offensive ability. It begins to melt you from the inside as it becomes like molten hot. So any metal object is going to detract, which would normally protect you, is in this case detracting from your ability to protect yourself.
It's actually hurting.
And in addition to that, hurting you.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, everybody's always got this problem with the Ironbreaker and how tough he is. Just throw a gold wizard into one of those battles and that Ironbreaker becomes completely useless.
We should probably talk about the Iron Breakers at some point. People have issues with them, but...
I have an Iron Breaker in my party, so I'd like to do a couple of these APs and see how... Because he is actually quite powerful, but I've got some...
Don't mock the listeners.
I have some stuff up. I have some stuff up my sleeve, so to try to throw them around a little bit.
LC has some issues with the APs.
Yeah, well, I don't have a true Ironbreaker, but the dwarf in my party is he's going that direction, and he's definitely favoring defense and soak over damage. So he's definitely kind of a sword and board type guy, and he's really tough to damage. But I found that wounds don't really mean that much in Warhammer 3rd. The wounds themselves are pretty fleeting, even for non-armored characters. But there are lots of ways to get around armor.
Well, let's make sure we answer his question, because I think there's one part we've skipped still, which is, what is the difference between soak and armor soak?
Yeah, soak is your toughness.
That there was.
Well, there isn't really, but there is the armor soak comes in addition to your actual character soak. Your character's soak value is his toughness.
Yes.
That's to represent your just physical grit and your ability to withstand damage as an individual not wearing armor. Your armor soak is something added on top of that, and that is specifically attributable to the quality or the type of armor that you're wearing. So this spell separates those two and it exclusively affects the armor soak value.
Well, your soak value would be the total overall soak of your toughness and your armor soak together.
Right.
The same thing, just different.
I'm going to play a literalist here, and just in terminologies. And granted, you know, I'm imperfect, and I haven't read every single card and every single line of the book. But most of the cards and things I've encountered, yeah, I know you're disgusted, right? I dropped several points in my viability here.
I mean, you're not an old guard anymore.
Yeah, come on, Jordan.
But the reading that I've gotten off of most of the rules and most of the cards that, you know, reference, you know, and items that reference soak and damage and soaking damage is that the mechanics specifically call toughness of your character just toughness. Yeah. So toughness is not soak at all. Soak is only the bonus that's applied to your toughness that you receive from armor and you know, things that grant you additional points are called soak. So armor gives you not toughness but soak.
Yeah,
and
but your toughness
the shield is... like the tower shield doesn't give you toughness, it gives you soak. And so that was my, because some cards say, you know, it ignores soak but not toughness, or it ignores toughness but not soak. And so that was my reading of it.
Yeah, that's how I interpret it, is that soak is your toughness plus your armor soak value. Yeah. But, you know.
No, I don't think that's true. Well, at least by the raw, I don't think soak is supposed to be completely separated from your toughness. Because most cards, when they say it ignores both, they'll actually say it ignores toughness and soak.
Hmm. But toughness acts as soak when you're taking damage, though, right?
Well, I mean, it does affect.
You can hit for nine, but if you hit for nine damage and you have two soak for your armor and a four toughness, you'll only take three wounds, right?
Right, right,
right.
Okay, so it's just the terminology is a little.
But
different.
So I guess again, this is just my understanding, my interpretation. But if something says ignore soak, it does not ignore toughness. It just ignores armor.
That's my understanding as well. You still will you'll always get your toughness reduction unless it says otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll do one more question here. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to one that I find a little intriguing, and maybe it's even a quick one. If it goes by quickly, we might do another one. But Player Bob, who has the fantastic name, emails, can you guys give me some ideas for cantrips? He's new to the Warhammer world and started playing a Grey Wizard, and he's a bit unclear as to what would be appropriate. And then he has a bonus question, which is, do cantrips scale?
What's a cantrip?
You could create a small noise. Usually it has to do with the specific school itself, like what your cantrip spells are capable of, but you could dim the room a little bit or change the color of your eyes or something.
Aside from the basic examples you're giving, a cantrip is a super simple expression of your magic. Like a fire, a bright wizard, for example, maybe could light a candle across the room. Something simple and easy. It's usually not
levitate
damaging.
Dice. Yeah, like levitate tube dice or whatever.
So for a gray wizard specifically, what can we come up with?
Well, one of the things they say is they like to change small features of their face using their cantrip spell. So they'll change the color of their eyes, or they'll put a mole on their face and then move it around on people, and like they do stuff
that's
like
so disturbing.
Well, they do stuff like that to trick people because gray wizards are all about shadowness and all that kind of stuff.
Maybe change the direction of a shadow that you could certainly. Dim the lights in a room. I think you had said earlier, Lester, would be very appropriate. Yeah. The other bonus question he has here is, do they scale? And I'm assuming what he means by that is, do cantrips get more powerful as your character levels up?
I would say no.
I would also say no. And the reason behind that is what level or rank 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 spells are there for.
Yeah, exactly.
The cantrips are always meant to be very, very basic and simple expressions of your craft.
Yeah, and I mean, really powerful wizards will still use cantrips. You know, even if they don't scale, they're always going to be doing stuff with that.
And I think you can almost cast them for free to a degree.
It is, yeah. But I mean, you can only do it for so long. And I mean, as a game master, I would put limits on it or make them have to expend, either expend power or not be able to charge power if they had a few active cantrips, like using a pen or using a quill to write something down while they research something in a book, you know?
Right. Well, I think casting a cantrip just costs like one power point or something. But most of the time that you'll be using cantrips is kind of in story mode anyway, so it's really
irrelevant. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to do one last question, and I think Jordan, why don't you read this one? We're going to go with this one here on the list.
Yeah, you try to say that.
This one from Masiak Yargas Jagasiak.
Okay, let's all make a guess on where this person's from.
Does anybody else want to take a stab at that name? Because I feel like I'm not even going to try.
I have no idea, but the question's a good one, so go ahead.
All right, well, pressing forward, ever forward. Hi, guys. So I got my Lure of Power recently, and I was really excited to see more cards for social actions. Jumped around a bit here. Especially since one of my current players is playing a burger character and he is ready to invest some advancements in social actions. So I looked them up and was stuck with a dilemma. How should I use them? Action cards for attacks or spells are kind of self-explanatory. Your character has his, hers unique style of fighting, no special moves, has mastered certain spells. Everything is fine here. But what is with social actions? Let's take a flirt action card, for example. Having this action card doesn't mean that the PC is extraordinarily good at flirting, because you still have to roll dice to see if your PC succeeded. And if you have a low fellowship charm, you shouldn't be flirting. You will probably fail the test. So what should you do? Forbid flirting to any PC who doesn't have the flirt action card? That's ridiculous. On the other hand, if the PCs are allowed to perform the same social actions as those that have social action cards, it will make these action cards pretty useless. The only use I see for them right now, this is a long one, by the way, but thanks for dumping this one on me.
I wanted to get you in there.
The only use I see for them right now is just to lay them down on the table while social encounter is played and let the players choose which social actions they want to perform. That way, social action cards would be a rules summary of social encounters listed that will make the game easier and faster, and that's, in my personal opinion, a bit of a shame. What do you think about that? Well...
I actually, my new character, Ella, I think she has a bunch of social cards rather than any action cards. And personally, I haven't found too much use for them. They just kind of sit around, and I feel like they're kind of just for certain situations where they might be a little fun to kind of enhance the effects of characteristics she already has. Because I chose the social cards kind of to go along with the character I already believe her to have. So that's how I'm using them. I don't know
do you have any examples of that?
So she's a healer, right? And she's supposed to be fairly mellow. And I think one of her action cards, or one of her, I don't know if that's action or social, the mellow out card.
Yeah, or simmer down now type of.
So, like, I just kind of felt like that's something she would be doing anyway, but now she's got a card with specific specs on it that, will have effects based on a dice roll.
I kind of feel that the social action cards, like flirt was, the flirt one was a great example that's pretty, pretty ubiquitous in a game where any PC can flirt. I mean, that's cool, no problem. They'll make a die roll, and they, we are all gamers. We may struggle with that periodically, but technically, from a mechanical perspective, everyone is capable of trying. What the card will do is I feel the card will allow that player who has the card to have a better chance of success, or if it's not a better chance of success, it's a better, an increased result So if they are ultimately successful, a player without an action card for flirt would get, you know, a marginal success rate. But somebody who succeeded while using a card might have a far more dramatic effect.
It's more, it's almost like it's more for the GM than anything else. It kind of gives him a directed path to take in terms of what the effect of that card is.
That's why I like what the asker of this question put forward, and to take out the main social actions and use them in that way, lay them out on the table during a social encounter, and then the players can pick. I want to, you know, I want to flirt with this person, or I want to intimidate this person, or whatever, as opposed to actually using them as purchasable for your character cards.
I can see what Jesse's saying, though, too. I think that was my initial assessment of them and some of the social actions that I've seen players take, and trying to figure out how to use those or how to interpret those as a GM. And that was kind of, I came to the same place, Jesse, where I thought, well, you know, anybody can use, you know, these basic types of actions. And this is true not only for social actions, but also for the general, a lot of the general support actions. Like there was one that was called Call of the Wild, which was, you know, it basically enhanced your ability to use the nature lore skill when you're out in the wilderness. And I think that's the key that I kept going to, is that, well, anybody can make kind of a basic use of a skill. You know, anybody can use nature lore to try and, you know, find a place to get out of the rain. But if you have Call of the Wild, for example, though, well, there's other benefits on the card for if you get, you know, boons, you get this. If you get three successes, you get this. So I kind of took the social actions to be the same way, that, yeah, you can flirt with fellowship and charm and your charm skill. But if you have flirt, then there are specific special rules, you know, on that card that are.
I do feel the gray area, though, is pretty wide here, where you want to make somebody feel like they have invested their points wisely by choosing a social card.
But it also depends on the player, though, right? Some players aren't looking to be combat specialists or anything like that. So
right, but you want to make them feel like the cards they chose were well spent and not wasted when they could have bought something else.
Sure.
And I find that a little difficult, but at the same time, I think it's if you can find ways that make it exciting or more exciting because they use the card versus not using it, that's where you find the success. And I think it's through giving them some extra bonuses or incentives for doing it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, with that, we'll wrap it up for the 26th episode, also known as the 50th piece of Reckless Dice content. We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site at recklessdice.com or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Reckless Dice. Till next time, thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
Peace.
Do they have trolls in Sweden?
I'm sure they do.
Is that considered the Netherlands?
No. Definitely not considered the Netherlands.
No.
How far north do you have to go before you're in
Norway?
Is Netherlands only Norway, or is it a region?
No, Netherlands isn't Norway at all.
What do you?
Holland. That's where fucking Amsterdam is, man. Just because it's
like
in the north
the map,
doesn't mean
Norway's up here.
That area, I get confused.
Denmark and Norway are together. They're like conjoined in their separate little continent up there.
They don't actually touch each other.
This guy right here gets confused when we go into that area a little bit. Like north of the Central Europe. I get confused.
Yeah, right? Well, there's Scandinavia, which
I've never visited.
It looks like Russia's phallus if you look at it laying on its side. There's Scandinavia, which is Sweden and Norway, and then you've got Finland, which isn't technically Scandinavia.
That's Norway. That's Denmark.
And then you have Denmark, which is a small little peninsula in northern Europe. That's where all the Vikings come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of.
I can. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll have to delete this section.
Right. Are you sure you don't want to keep it?
I mean, it makes me sound.
Because I think it's kind of funny.
It makes me sound smart.
The Netherlands. So that's Norway. And what? Like, what the fuck? You must have got a school in America.
I mean, to be fair, those countries are all fairly similar anyway.
That's where I'm coming from.
Netherlands is nothing like Norway or Sweden.
You only know this because you're at a similar longitudinal.
Well, because I like studying and stuff, because it's where my ancestors come from. But Netherlands is completely different. It's closer to France and Belgium. And it's like got a lot of Gaelic, or not Gaelic.
All I'm really trying to do here is figure out where the trolls from the movie I watched.
Norway.
They were from Norway.
Yes.
They were from Sweden.
No.
Which is right by Norway.
You wanted them to be from Sweden.
Didn't the thing say a Danish, or was it Swedish, documentary film?
Well, let's find out. What was it called? Troll Hunter?
Mm-hmm. It's called Troll Hunter, right?
Blooper reel insert here.
This conversation's really special.
Well, we got him to sell it as a DVD, man. It's a behind-the-scenes DVD.
I could have sworn it was Norwegian.
I think you're right. I think it's a Norwegian student film.
And there's no click more button.
But I mean, if there's trolls in Norway, they can always cross the border into Sweden. So. Okay.
No, they can't, because trolls they will don't care kill about citizenship. Before they do that.
That's right.
By the epic troll hunter.
That's right. Who is very mysterious. Yeah.
Haven't you seen the movie?
How are you gonna convince a troll to pay taxes?
How? Oh, that wasn't a joke. I was waiting for a punchline.
No, that was the punchline.
All right. Let's stop talking for like 10 seconds so I can figure out where this debacle ends.
Let's get our tweet on.
Why are you no productive with your time?
That 10 seconds actually needs to happen quietly, though.
You're pushing it here.
No, we're reading the movie poster of Troll Hunter, and its caption is "Pretty damn spectacular."